Welcome to my basement, everybody. We've got a very special episode today, and it's a celebration of LlamaSoft, the Jeff Minter story. The game has launched, or should I say this compilation, this collection of incredible games through many different years, celebrating the work of Jeff Minter, who is one of the most acclaimed indie developers in the game industry's history. I first met Jeff back in 1995 after already having been entranced by his work, specifically on Tempest 2000 on the Atari Jaguar, which I became obsessed with. And as I started to dive into this collection, I started to appreciate his full body of work, his breadth of work, and his artistry. And it's really wonderful. And the man who helped to assemble this collection is Chris Kohler, who's an editorial director at Digital Eclipse. Jeff Minter and Chris Kohler both join me now here in the basement. And guys, it is a real treat to have you both here. Welcome. Jeff, I'm going to start with you. What is it like to have a collection like this created around your work? How does that feel?
It feels kind of strange, really. I always feel like how can I deserve something like this, really? It's so good and it's so nicely presented. And it's the kind of thing which I would have thought I would like to do one day myself, but I would never have had the skills to be able to do it. Yeah. So to have it done so wonderfully, I mean, I absolutely love what they did with the Atari 50 collection. So to have that same treatment given to me and to LlamaSoft has been absolutely fantastic. It's really, you know, like beyond a dream, really. It's excellent. I love it.
Oh, that's lovely. Lovely to hear. And I feel the same way playing through it and watching it. And you are absolutely deserving of this recognition. And I think one of our greatest failings, and I think Chris will back me up with that, in our industry is how quickly we forget and how fast we move forward. And there's so many great individuals in this business that have really stacked the building blocks to allow others to keep building on top of and entertaining us with over the years. Chris, why was Jeff so important for Digital Eclipse, and why did you guys work so hard? And again, congratulations on this compilation, and also Digital Eclipse kind of staking out its own brand, its own name out here with these defining sort of Criterion Collection-esque, compilations. It's really wonderful work.
I mean, There's just so many great stories out there that, as you say, are just not being told nearly enough. Jeff's is certainly one of them. And, you know, we have to recognize that, you know, old video games are not just old video games. They're the foundational building blocks of a medium and an industry. And not only that, but, So since this came out, I mean, just a little, you know, personal story of what happened just last night is that, you know, my wife downloaded it onto Steam, and she ended up playing through one of Jeff's earliest games, 3D, which was this maze game that ran extremely slowly on the ZX81, like very, very slowly. But we actually boosted it by 50x speed. And when you boost it by 50x speed, the fun of the game, you know, kind of emerges because you're moving through this 3D maze. And she played it until she got out of the maze. Then she moved on to playing one of Jeff's early games, D-Flex, for the Commodore VIC-20. And then my 9-year-old was playing D-Flex, and he was sitting there, and they were trying to beat each other's high scores playing D-Flex. And it shows you, I think, really two things, one of which is that there is an enduring quality to these games. You know, we're not just looking back at history, but we're making them available again to people. I mean, these games may have been, is the cassette tape image for D-Flex on the VIC-20 somewhere out there on the internet? Sure. Is there a VIC-20 emulator somewhere out there on the internet? Yes. But if we put together a package like this and make it available to people, and it's importantly show people this is what this is why you might consider playing it, you can really expand the audience and people's knowledge of history, you know, create new fans of Jeff Minter. You know, I mean, there's so much that can be done when you bring this stuff back in a way that's easy for people to play, and then also put it in that proper context and really show how these games are not just, you know, a ROM you might find on a sketchy ROM site somewhere, but it's when you put it all together, it's the story of a life. It's the story of a creator. And so, an artist. You know, from our perspective, we love you know, the fact that we were, you know, that Jeff, that you trusted us essentially to tell this story, and to do this, you know, with your work that is so personal to you.
Jeff, did you have a sense of the enduring resonance of this medium when you were, you know, dabbling with this stuff and learning it and building it? I mean, you must have had some heroes that you looked up to. Maybe you didn't know their name, but you certainly knew their work. But did you know the ripple effect of all of this back then?
Well, I mean, at first, when we first started to make games, I mean, I did it with like four other people in my entire sixth form college, and there was only one computer in the whole place. Yeah. And we were making games for each other. And at that point, I don't think we ever thought it could even be something like a game industry. It was just something which we did to amuse ourselves. And it was only, you know, two or three years later when Sinclair brought out his cheap machines and this industry started to emerge from its very first seeds, that there was even any thought given to the idea that maybe you could make a career out of this, and maybe it might have something that it might be something that was worth pursuing, you know, as a career. I mean, I certainly did have heroes back in those days. I mean, one in particular who I always talk about is Eugene Jarvis, of course.
Right.
I mean, obviously, we all looked up to the arcade scene was what we all aspired to, especially in the early days. I mean, a lot of us started out by just copying arcade games. And I still remember the exact place where I first ever saw Defender Machine and the effect it had on me. And it was just so different than anything else that was around at the time, with the explosions that shattered all over the screen and the absolutely nails-hard difficulty and the incredible sound effects. And then it just ate all my money. And then I remember walking away from it and thinking, all the way I was walking back to my grand's place, I was thinking, wow, one day I just hope I could make a game as good as that, because that was amazing. I didn't even know the name of Eugene Jarvis at that point.
Yes.
I wanted to make a game that was as fierce and as wonderful and as, you know, immersive as that was. And then in later years, I actually got to meet Eugene, which was a huge pleasure. But yeah, so I mean, we were there before the dawn of time, really, in terms of the video game. We were there like 2 years before, waiting for everybody else to show up. And they finally did start to show up. It was quite good because we had a little bit of a head start. It was good.
Well, what I'm kind of getting from, and I don't want to spoil too much of your history because that's really examined in this collection. It's a beautiful portrait of, you know, your start in school and your relationship with your parents and how you kind of figured it out. But what I'm also understanding is that even as the British game scene, the UK game scene was starting to take off, you were still kind of independent from that even. You were your own driving force. And did you connect with other UK game developers? Did you, you know, I see you went to some of the, you know, conventions and things and events and things, but were you also building friendships and partnerships? Did you collaborate with any of those other game makers that were up and coming at that time?
I was never really a collaborator. It was always, I guess I was kind of put off with some of the early experience I had where some people tried to hook up with me and I tried to sell my games through other people, and they always ended up having bad time. You know, things always went a bit wrong, and that kind of pushed me to be very independent. It pushed me to the point where I thought, well, I just want Larmasoft to be for, you know, for my stuff,
right?
But that doesn't mean that I didn't admire the work of others. Of course I did, and we used to go to these computer exhibitions, and I met a lot of the other coders there, and they were a lot like me, really. We were just like kids who suddenly found ourselves at the epicenter of this thing that was starting to happen. And we were all looking around and blinking in the light and going, well, how the hell did this happen? But we, you know, by and large, we all got on, and we'd all, you know, go to the bar together, have a few drinks, go out into London and go into the arcades at night, you know, after the day at the exhibition. And we got
Really well. That is awesome. And, I, on the other side of the pond, here was Chris and I, you know, happily eating up all of this work that was happening and just having our minds blown, you know, which must be surreal for you, Chris. Now, you've now started this career to work with legends, you know, and maybe these legends deserve more recognition and awareness because we're so quick to just dismiss the past in this business. But You know that Jeff is a legend. I don't want to make you uncomfortable, Jeff, but you're a freaking legend. You were a legend when I started Electric Playground, and you're more of a legend now. But it must be crazy for you, Chris, to work with people like Jeff and build these things with these guys.
It's wonderful. It really is. And I mean, you know, when I was in the media for, you know, nearly 25 years, you know, Vic, as you know, and like, yep. I always really enjoyed getting those opportunities to sit in front of game developers that had made stuff in the 80s and 90s and to talk to them about their older work, which was not, that's not what the PR people wanted me to talk about.
Nope.
But it's like, you know, there's just these games in many cases, you know, were kind of developed in a black box, and like, we didn't know very much about the people who made them. So when I sat down, you know, and I would sit down with somebody from, you know, Nintendo, and they wanted me to talk about the latest Animal Crossing game on the DS or whatever, and then ask them, like, hey, when did you join Nintendo? What did you kind of work on? And they say they were a level designer on Super Mario Brothers 3. It's like, oh, my God, Super Mario Brothers 3. Nobody ever talks about that. We got to talk about that. So to now get to do that and have the output of, you know, to get to, you know, speak with developers like Jeff, you know, to get to put together these histories of these games, to really get to delve into them and to have the output of that be an actual interactive video game versus an article or something like that. It's really, yeah, it is really wonderful. And you know, it's great to, like, literally during the day, during my day job, have that job be to, like, read Jeff's History of LlamaSoft book, or go digging around the internet to see what I can find as far as magazine scans or articles or things like that that reference LlamaSoft, and to start to put together the pieces of that story. Because, you know, in America, I mean, again, most of us, you know, probably heard of Jeff Minter for the first time with Tempest 2000 on the Atari Jaguar.
And Edge Magazine and Tempest 2000, 100%.
Yeah. And basically just like, oh, yeah, you know, Jeff Minter, this guy's a legend. But like, we're receiving that. We're hearing about that. We're hearing, oh, he was a legend in Britain. Oh, okay. Because like, so many of those games never came out here, were never really covered here. So we didn't really understand who Jeff Minter the person was. But to go back and to read all of the articles, I mean, Jeff, you know, he was writing columns in the British video game magazines, and they were writing about him, and there was, and he was, I mean, he was just this iconic figure where even if an article wasn't even about Jeff Minter, somebody might make a Jeff Minter joke somewhere, and it was understood that the whole audience knew if somebody joked about like a sweater with llamas on it, that they knew exactly who they were talking about, because he was this very well-known figure. And so it's so much fun to read about that. But then you get into the spirit of that, and then it's like, well, I'm making this game not just for people in Britain, but for people around the world. So it's like, how do you tell the story? How do you express to people like who Jeff was in the 80s or 90s? So that's like the fun challenge, to get to really bring that to a new audience. But, you know, you read the story and you read, you know, all the crazy things that had happened to Jeff, or getting pericarditis, which is, you know, left him, hey, he was in bed for months, and that's why he, you know, was able to program game. All these things. It's, the story is so interesting. And I think that's whenever you start looking into who made these games, where did they make these games? Because these are British games. It's so important that they were made where they were. When were they made? And what were the tools, and how were they made? And importantly, like, I mean, I think the really big question we're answering with Jeff Minter's story is why did Jeff make these games? Because when you start looking at the games and understanding what was driving him to make them, in the case of like, you know, in the case of like Andy's Attack, just having played Defender. And gotten just so into it that he just had to go home and make one, you know, it's like, that's when you understand the passion that went into it, it means so much more than it does if you were to just, like, again, sort of like randomly download a tape image off the internet and play it.
100%.
That context.
Yes. Yeah, this is not just a business about products. And I think that the industry boils it down to that. And one of the things that, and by the way, for those that are listening to this podcast, Jeff Minter has been served some tea and cookies. So this is a real thing, guys. We're having actually, this right now. He's got his tea. I got my tea. I've got my Canadian tea. Cheers.
I'll tell you what's actually worse about this. This is actually a cup of coffee, because today we ran out of tea.
Oh no. Oh, you're not just doing it because you're hanging with North Americans. You're drinking it because you're out of tea.
it's Italian coffee, though. It's espresso.
Oh, okay. All right. Keeping it in Europe. That's cool. One of the things that impressed me, and again, I don't want to spoil it because so much of this game, and it's not a game. It's so much more than a game. It's all the games. It's 42 games, but it's also this documentary, you know, beautiful work on the documentary with lots of great backup interviews with all kinds of interesting people and analysis and documentation. But one of the things that impressed me is the handmade quality of it. And somehow, Jeff, like the llama became your spirit animal. And you're 20 or you're 21 and you're like defining your mythology. And do you reflect on that? Like, how does someone that young have the presence of mind to kind of determine themselves like that for the world? Cause you instantly become larger than life as the llama guy, you know, and it must be surreal to see that work and reflect back. You were so young and you were so present with it, which is really impressive. God, I think of myself as 20 and most people we have no clue who we are or what we're going to do. And it's like, you knew right then, which is really amazing.
Yeah. But I think part of the reason that I got into everything, really, that I got into coding, got into programming, was that I didn't really know what my place in the world was going to be. I'd come up through the educational system, kind of with one foot in the sciences and maths and one foot in, you know, the artistic side and English literature and stuff. I was into that kind of, and I felt divided. I didn't feel that either one of those two things was the thing which would really fire my soul, you know? Mm-hmm. And then when I just accidentally discovered programming, purely accidentally, I found out somebody was typing a game into a computer, and I thought, that's a very interesting idea that you could actually start making a game by typing out a computer. Maybe I should learn a bit more about that.
Yeah.
And then when I started to do it, it was like, wow, this is a completely new form of creativity that I'd never even imagined before. And it was hugely compelling. I just immediately started spending every moment of my spare time doing it. And it was at a time as well where I wasn't really fitting into any kind of social scene. I felt a little bit kind of outside of everything.
Yep.
Not particularly comfortable in the world at that time. And coding is a very lovely deterministic space. If things are not feeling right in the real world, you can go into the code world where, yeah, if anything is going wrong, you can always fix it if you think enough. The answer is always there. You can always make things right when you're writing code. So it was
That's the flip of that is to play these games too, right? Like if you're not feeling right in your world, and there are major movements right now to look at games as a healing source, as a way to kind of improve your life. And I always think of, I have no idea how to make a game, and Chris is learning all the ins and outs of how to do that now. But I imagine a lot of how you make a game is you're kind of playing it in reverse. You know, the making of it is a game in a way. You game that, you know, that problem solving sort of element of it.
The skill basically is having an idea and understanding how to break that down into small bits, which you can describe in the language to hand.
Yeah.
And it's not that difficult of a skill, but you need to be, it's like any artistic thing, really. When some people are really good at drawing, some people are really good at music, and some people are good at having these ideas in their head and transcribing them into computer code and coming out with something that's enjoyable. And I think if you've got the bug for that and the moment you start to do it, I mean, you pretty much know straight away if that's your thing. But if it is your thing, it just consumes you. There's nothing else like it.
You've always had this beautiful relationship with music in your work and visual stimulation, psychedelic stimulation. Are you a musician? Do you have do you compose things? Do you create your own music?
Well, I used to play a bit of piano when I was a kid. I strum on the guitar every now and again, but I'm not very good. But I do enjoy, for my current project, I actually wrote a little sequencer, and then I've been making tunes with my own sequencer of my own design, which is quite fun to do, because then I can hook that up to the game and make it respond to things that are happening in game. In my recent game, Akka R, as well, I did a little bit of musical noodling there with these little fairly abstract themes that come in on each level.
That was such a cool game, man. I didn't know what the hell was going on in that game for so long. And it was really tripping me out. I played it on a flight on my Switch, and I'm like, what is happening here? And I finally clued in. I was like, whoa, this is, it's real. That's a lot of your games, isn't it? It's a lot of, like, you sync to them. They're very different. And one of my favorite descriptions in the documentary stuff is, like, these games are you. You know, we get a piece of you in your work. And I love that about your work. And so you have to kind of, as a player, you kind of have to meet you in a way. You have to kind of, you know, your mind has to jibe with what you're putting together. And Ankar was, how do you say it? Ankar?
I always call it Akka R.
Akka R, yeah. That was a mind trip. But is that the philosophy that you have as a maker? You want people to feel the touch on you and the touch from you, and then kind of figure out how to play it based on their awareness of that?
Well, I think I would like people to enjoy the process of discovery. I like to put things in the game which perhaps you wouldn't see straight away when you first start to play. But then as you start to play and understand things a bit more, then things which, things you might have overlooked before will suddenly go, oh, that fits in with this. And if I do this, then you get a better feedback loop. But I think that the more I go on, the more I want to make it easier for people to reach the kind of Zen states that I want people to experience in these games.
Because awesome.
The more I work on games, the less it's about sort of something that's adversarial, something that's going to make you wound up and upset, and the more it is about leading you to this peaceful flow state where you sync with the game. And then when you get there, it just feels wonderful. We were talking earlier on about games being a bit therapeutic, and sometimes these games can be like that. You can put yourself into this lovely chill state.
Absolutely.
Where you've been agitated or upset in the outside world, you can just chill out in there and come out with a smile on your face. I've been saying a lot recently, I sometimes watch on YouTube those stupid videos about people who smash their gear up when their games aren't going right. That is the direct opposite of what I want my games to do to people.
Of course, yeah. Chris, Chris, you must have been hearing from a lot of fans and friends of Jeff during this last little while. I'm sure, in the collection of these stories and this material, all kinds of new information has filtered up in your world. You're probably the world's leading expert on Jeff Minter at this point right now.
As far as, like Llamasoft history and having now kind of having it hammered into my brain of which games came out in which order. And yeah, exactly.
Has there been something that stands out, like some kind of, I don't know, a review or an anecdote or a peer, maybe another developer, has come out and talked to you about Jeff's work? I'm just curious about the reactions around the Jeff Minter story.
I'm just so excited to see what games people remember. But then again, there's games in here that very few people ever experienced. And again, even if you wanted to, going back to 3D, I tried to get that running in a ZX81 emulator, to kind of try it out as I was trying to play every game as we were doing the research. And I simply couldn't do it. It's like I had an emulator, I had the image, and it simply wouldn't run. To be able to get past all of that friction for everybody, and to see what new surprises people might find. I mean, for me, I really just love Headbanger's Heaven, which I'm telling everybody about this because, again, it's not something that I ever would have experienced otherwise, but it's so funny. And Jeff wrote this whole hilarious intro for it about the main character and about, the joke is so good too. I mean, the idea that he's a headbanger, but yes, he does like heavy metal music, but he also likes to get banged on the head by heavy metal hammers. and that he's a pain addict and loves getting hit on the head with the hammers, but But you know, if you get hit in the head with a hammer too much, you die. And it's just, it's so funny. It's so ridiculous. There's Hitchhiker's Guide references in the game. And it's exactly like, it's like the sort of stuff we all kind of made when we were teenagers, because I'm pretty sure Jeff was either a teenager or just out of his teens when he made it. Just this, you know, funny references to things that we like, you know, all these in jokes, but then the game itself is also a lot of fun to play. And, you know, so again, just to be able to put that kind of stuff in front of people and have them discover something that is from the early 80s, you know, that is like 40 years old, that is something that is still very, very funny and worth playing today. It's like there's certain games that get to have a long tail, a long history, yeah, you know?
And I'm all about the camels games, the Attack of the Mutant Camels. I mean, I have such a love-hate relationship with the Atari 2600 Empire Strikes Back cartridge. Like, that sticks in my head. So, like, spending the money to get that home, and I'm just doing the same thing again and again. But to see Jeff's take on that and how funny it was and how cool it is, and it's just awesome, you know?
The thread coming up over and over again is, I mean, it's even come up with Jeff talking about Defender. I mean, it's like Jeff sees something, and it's like, I should make that game, and then goes home and makes the game. Somebody says in a magazine that the AT-ATs look like big camels, and Jeff is like, ha, big camels, goes home, makes exactly that game, you know. But I mean, that's what separates Jeff from the rest of us, is that, you know, when he sees something and he's like, well, I have an idea for the version of this that I'm gonna make, and then, you know, goes and makes that. And it's this dialogue, you know, back and forth. And but again, unless you know that context, and unless you wrap that context around the games and you re-release it, you don't understand how funny it is or where it fits into that context. Or maybe you can guess at it, but you know, to actually have it there, it just makes it more meaningful, because
but even more than that though is all the storytelling around it, you know, the direct interviews with Jeff and hearing from it. I mean, that's been my mission the whole way along too, is like, these things are more than products, guys. They're right. Human beings, you know? Right. And back in the day, there was a lot less of them, a lot less people, a lot less games, and people were figuring it out. And so it's vitally important that we preserve this material and share it and celebrate it. But Jeff, I want to talk a little bit about your relationship with Atari. And it's interesting now, because Digital Eclipse is an Atari studio, and Chris is an employee of Atari. And I know that you have been in and out of employment with Atari, and in and out of, you know, maybe some tenuous and, you know, tension filled relationships with Atari.
Complicated.
Yes. How do you feel about Atari in this day and age, and this journey that you've been on with this company? When I met you in 1995, you were working in California on Defender 2000, and you had a stint away from the UK, and you were working in North America. And you know, talk to us a little bit about, you know, your long history and your feelings of working with Atari.
Well, I mean, Atari have been there throughout my whole video game life, really. I mean, when I first wanted to get a game console, I couldn't afford an Atari 2600 that was out at the time. This is when I was at sixth form college, while I was learning to program on the Commodore PET. I desperately also wanted to get an Atari home console. I couldn't afford one. I ended up getting this fairly inferior sort of, it was a cartridge programmable system, which was nowhere near as powerful as the Atari, but it was like 50 quid cheaper, and it was all I could afford. But I desperately wanted an Atari. And there was a video game shop I used to go to, and they always had an Atari VCS in there, so I'd always go in there and just waste their time, basically, just sit there and trying the newest games out. And then when I got to university, I blew like a whole term's money on going and buying an Atari 2600 and a copy of Space Invaders.
That's money well spent.
I remember I had to more or less live on baked beans for the rest of that term, because I'd spent all my money on this Atari VCS. But I mean, it was at that point Atari was this godlike company, producing the best video game, home video games you could get, and some of the best arcade games you could possibly get. And I never thought I would actually intersect with them in any meaningful way at that point. I was just a kid, and even though I was making games, I was just making stupid little games on the Commodore PET, and nothing like what they were doing. And so in later years, when you know, Atari's became more of a thing in my life, with the Atari ST, and I got to have a working relationship with Atari UK, and then they started talking to me about new consoles they're working on, and would I be interested in doing stuff on? I was like, hell yes, would I be interested in doing that? Oh, and another absolutely bizarre coincidence, which happened regarding Atari and my getting into the consoles there. So this is work on the Atari ST for them. Also, the first Amiga programming I ever did was for Atari, strangely enough.
Oh, wow.
There was an Atari UK spin-off label called Arc Software, and I was doing some stuff for them. I did some ST games, and they wanted to have Amiga ports. So my first Amiga work was done for Atari, strangely enough. And then they wanted me to do a game on the Atari Falcon when that was coming out. So I had to go down to their headquarters in Slough and pick up an Atari Falcon prototype from there. While I was there, I said, oh, yeah, the VP of hardware at Atari is here. Do you want to say hello to him? I said, yeah, okay. Door opens. This guy comes in. His name is Richard Miller. He was my best mate at school.
Oh, wow.
And he got to Atari via a completely different route to me.
That's so cool.
I was like, oh, I really do.
That's fantastic.
From that, I got into working on the Jaguar, and that again, a strange relationship with the time. And when I was working on Tempest 2000, and they showed an early prototype of it at the launch party of the Jaguar, and it wasn't anywhere near complete. I think it was still all vector graphics at that point. It wasn't filled polys or anything.
Yeah.
One of the designers of the Jaguar, a British guy called John Matheson, came up to me. We were both in our cups, rather. And he was saying, oh, I don't like your game. He said, it doesn't use the strength of the Jaguar at all. Atari aren't really going to care about it. I don't think it's very good. I thought, well, that's not a very nice thing to say.
Oh, man. Wow.
So later on, when the game was finished, and it actually turned out rather well, it was rather pleasing to see him have to eat his words.
Oh, my God, that game is incredible. That game is amazing.
And and then I got to work for Atari, and it was all right, but I didn't do as good work as an employee as I did as a freelancer. Mm. And I think the reason for that was, as an employee, you get leaned on a lot more to push the game in a direction which I didn't particularly want it to go. In the case of Defender 2000, they wanted to have big sprites and lots of parallax layers and stuff like that. And now, the game like Defender, big sprites are not what you want.
Right. You
know, a fairly small ship with lots of room to maneuver, and it needs to be very clearly visible. But with lots of these parallax layers, you tend to lose the ship in the background unless it's the size of a bus. And if the ship is the size of a bus, then you haven't got the space to maneuver. And when you play that game, you can actually play it more effectively by actually playing it by looking at the scanner than looking at the real screen.
Right.
And I think I would have done a better job of that game if I'd stayed at home in Wales and done it as a freelancer, because I think I'd have got a lot less pressure on me and I would have had a lot more scope to do things my own way.
Yeah.
So I don't think for me being an employee was the best thing, but it was still an honour to work at Atari for a while. I mean, it was, as I said, it'd been such this company that I'd idolised so much when I was growing up. So to actually be there and be a part of it was extraordinarily good.
You got to have those life experiences. Were you in Sunnyvale?
Yes.
Yeah, amazing. That's great. Yeah, and
it was lovely to be there. And my dad was also into video games. I got him into video games with that the first Atari VCS I had.
Sure.
And it turned out that his last holiday was to come out and see me in California, and so to be able to take him into Atari HQ and show him round was really lovely. He really enjoyed that.
That's awesome. Was Dan Van Eldren there at that time?
Who, does that sound familiar?
Dan Van Eldren?
I didn't know Dan Van Eldren.
Don't know him? No. Ed Logg might have been there around that time. I'm not sure. I mean, I met a bunch of people.
Like Dave Stalgus was there. Rob Zdibble was there. People like that. I mean, this was kind of mid-generation Atari. This was Atari. So there were some old hands there, but some of them had left to go to Atari Games, which was a separate people, so it was a separate thing by then. So what I saw was kind of a mixture of the two generations, really.
You mentioned that you had a chance to talk and meet with Eugene Jarvis, who is also a hero of mine. I had him on the podcast, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. And he's an incredible guy. And I'm wondering if you guys ever chatted seriously about any kind of a collaboration, because a lot of your work has been a reflection of the arcade experience, even your own. You know, you've had games that emulate some arcade types of ideas, and you interpret them in your own way. But you've also created totally original projects that feel very arcadey. And Eugene's whole mission today is to bring out arcade games. And he's got these great relationships with all of these arcades across North America, probably the whole world. And I'm wondering if you guys have ever chatted about possibly putting out a project together. I think that'd be amazing.
Well, years and years ago, it almost happened. I was kind of in tangential contact with them, and there was this idea that maybe at some point we talk about doing a collaboration. But then a few years later, when I brought it up again, it was off the idea at that point, and so it never really happened. But yeah, it would be nice to do an arcade game through his company. I see him very much as doing the arcade version of what I'm doing, is trying to keep the arcade game style alive.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of modern arcades are just fruit machines and ticket machines and stuff like that, and they're not really like the old games used to be.
Yes.
His company is trying to keep there's something of the spirit of the old arcade going, which is something which I very much appreciate. And anyway, I'm kind of trying to do that with my little games. By doing, not a lot of people work in the arcade game style anymore, but I love it, so I carry on doing it. So I think we've kind of got a similar mission in mind.
Absolutely, Chris. What is it about that that immediacy, that sort of twitchy kind of quality of Jeff's games and other arcade style games that remains relevant in 2024? And why should people make space and make time to engage with games like that? Because we're living in a sea of, live service experiences and 200-hour role-playing games and stuff. But, I'm from the era that really greatly appreciates things like Time Pilot. And Jeff, I saw you playing Time Pilot in some of the video content. It's like, I love that game.
I love Time Pilot.
It's such an amazing game. I don't know what Konami is doing sitting on that. But Chris, talk to us about the value of arcade games still today.
I think, I think it goes back to this idea of we're in this industry where things are considered to be disposable, and people are just constantly asking what is new, what is new, what is new. Whereas I think there's a lot of value. Again, the anecdote that I was telling earlier about the family playing D-Flex and playing 3D and stuff like that. And it's like, why are we just forgetting about these games? These games are still very much fun. They're still things that people can have a good time with if they're constructed well. Not everything has aged perfectly, but a lot of stuff has aged quite well. And especially if we can, sometimes even if something hasn't aged well, again, just bring it back to the 3D and us boosting it by 50x, you know what I mean? Like you can add some of that quality of life stuff. You can add things like rewind, you can add things like saving and loading, and you can take something that was just, just kind of close to perfect or close to something that people would play in the modern era. And you can take it the rest of the way there, and you can make it relevant again. And sometimes you don't even really even need to do that. Sometimes the work of art was already perfectly fun to play, but we're just so focused on the new thing, the new thing, the new thing, that we have to figure out, I think, as an industry, like, how do we keep games in print? I mean, I think keeping games in print is such a huge part of it. People say not only about these, but there's other games out there where people are like, well, you can just emulate it, right? Like, why does it need to be re-released? There's a fan translation. Why does it need to be officially translated, right? It's because when you are doing something where somebody has to get an emulator and a ROM, when they have to download it from some ROM site that's showing ads that say there's a virus on your computer and is flashing things in their face, or having to tweak emulator settings. There's just too much friction there to reach the mass audience.
More than that, look at the work that you guys are doing. Look at the Cowabunga collection and what you don't get when you just rip those ROMs. You don't get the design documents. You don't get the art and the backs of the boxes. And look, you've digitized and scanned in all of this incredible, precious documentation with these games. To see the hand-drawn covers for these games that went with the VIC-20 cassette tapes, that's incredible. Like, who knew there was this physical? And honestly, we're moving away from physical. We're getting into more and more digital stuff to preserve this stuff, these physical things in digital form like this. So freaking valuable. And
well, get to see when Steinerlund sent us over the original or the really high res clean versions of the airbrushed art that he would do for Jeff's game covers. But then also when he was like, oh, well, here's the photograph of the camel that I took that served as the sketch of the camel for Attack of the Mutant Camels 89, which wasn't even released. I mean, as the history nerd, I love to be able to bring that stuff to people and arrange it in such a way that they can see, here's the photo, here's the sketch, here's the finished version. I just love looking at that kind of stuff. And so, it's sort of a miracle that any video game gets made. And so the fact that the stars aligned where, like, we had the funding to do this, we have the team to do this, we're able to put Jeff's games out there. We want to, we realize we have one shot, you know what I mean? At getting it right the first time. This is the first time, could be the only time. It's like, we have to do it 110%, this Cowabunga collection, very similar. In fact, and then you have the external license of the Ninja Turtles. So it's like, this might be the only time this ever happens. So how many design documents are we going to put into this collection? Every single one of them. All of them. Well, we have one shot.
You guys are killing it. And one of the things that I really noticed with the making of Karateka, I think it's Karateka or it's Karateka, I can never know. But one thing I noticed with that and with Jeff Minter's collection here is there are also odes to the family and odes to the parents in such a beautiful way. And you really get a sense that it's a whole family that puts this stuff together. And that's
Jeff's mother was back there at those conventions, serving tea to all the LlamaSoft fans and talking up the games. And it was absolutely a full on family affair. And again, Karateka is very similar to what Jeff was doing, is that, anything that is a solo, anything that's credited to one person as a solo work, there is a support system around that person. Oh, yeah. And when you look at that support system, you get an even broader a picture and an understanding. And so, of course, we're always looking for what's that support system? Who are the people behind, the makers of the games? How did they impact the games that you're playing, and finding those unsung heroes of, video games, whether it be Jordan Mechner's father and sister, working on Karateka, or, Jeff's mom
and brother,
Tita LlamaSoft fans and brothers and Jeff's dad going to the conventions and talking with the other dads about dad stuff. And it's like, all of that is part of that. And you have to bring that forward, because otherwise we're going to lose those stories. And that is a part of video game history. And again, it's like, it's the part of video game history that sort of gets erased and whitewashed out when we're just concentrating on, the absolute biggest things of certain stories.
Well, it's always products. That's what I'm having such an issue with the way that we talk about this medium right now. It's just all just about the finished product all the time, and its value and its sales numbers and its rating, its score, and it's got it. The three of us know it's a freaking miracle to build anything, and video games are so goddamn hard to see to their completion. And it's, we should respect them more and appreciate them more. So I'm really, really happy that this came together, and that this seems to be the work that Digital Eclipse is building its reputation on. And I'm wondering, you've done a few of these now, and I'm wondering, Chris, what you learned off the Jeff Minter project that was maybe different? Or, you know, what are you taking from project to project as you go along here?
Well, you know, with this was very different from Karateka, because Karateka was one video game that took 2 or 3 years essentially to make. And there's many design documents and artifacts, and the whole sort of process of making this one game was very constantly sort of documented. Whereas we're looking at literally almost in some sense some of the same time periods with Jeff, from like 81 to 84 was where a lot of these games were made. But it was
That's
just
amazing.
This rapid fire succession of game after game after game, and there's not as much documentation for any one, because I mean in a lot of cases I feel like it was Jeff sitting down in front of his computer and just typing until a video game came out. And so it's like,
yeah,
people were asking, it's like, is there concept art? No, there's no concept art. There was no time for that. So then the challenge for me is, well, how do you build that story? It's like, well, where do you go and get information? And so in this case, it was like, how can I find a picture of, the street that Jeff grew up on? How do I find a picture of
right.
the planetarium where they did the launch for Color Space for the SD, all that kind of stuff. So how do you fill in those details? And it's really about like just, thinking about context and thinking about like, well, what could we potentially show? So that was sort of the big challenge for this one, was to sort of tell that story in that way and figure out what kinds of things we could illustrate it with that goes beyond just the game. So every project is a new kind of challenge, and it's like figuring out how to handle that.
That's cool. And it's interesting too, is like the Jordan project was more about a guy trying to bring narrative to video games and interweaving gameplay into this complex story that he was putting together, and seeing the value in building interactive work like that. And there is some storytelling in Jeff's work, but more than anything, it's about feel, it's about touch, it's about stimulation. And I'm wondering, did you ever meet Jordan Mechner in your travels? Were you guys ever at the same conventions or anything like that back then, Jeff?
No, I didn't really get to meet a lot of the American developers, really, because although I went to a few US things in the very early days, I think probably the most... the sort of famous guy at the time when I was there, who I met, was a guy called Tom Greiner, who was absolutely the best VIC-20 programmer in the world. This guy was technically absolutely amazing. I was in awe of the stuff he was producing. But I never really met any of the big names, really. I was in the UK scene and the US scene, especially in the home computer side of things.
Yeah.
The US scene was entirely separate than ours, really. Even though we had some of the US games come over, the games that most people played were developed in the UK by the people that everybody knew from the UK shows. So there wasn't a great deal of crossover. But yes, it's interesting what you say about narrative and the kind of stuff I do. My stuff's always been more about developing a feeling and trying to convey a feeling.
Yeah.
It's a visceral thing. And I think as I go on, I'm leaning even more into that. I'm barely telling any story at all. I'm just saying, use this and it will take you to a particular mind space.
Yeah, that's the Nintendo methodology. And then they add the story after the feel, which has its roots in arcades, I think, that idea of pulling you in.
Perhaps to make up for that, I used to delight in making up stupid stories for the attackers and camels and revenge and camels and all that. I would sit down in front of my mum's Macintosh and bash this stuff out. But I never tried to tell those stories in the game. I just had those in the instructions.
I did like your reaction to the Falkland War and creating the bombing game.
It was absolutely done as a piss take. And then when I think we can't remember, it was the Daily Telegraph or something like that. One of the big newspapers sort of took it up as a serious thing. So this is a great thing. He's made this. I was like, for fuck's sake, no, that wasn't what I meant. Sorry, excuse my language. But that was just,
no, it's all good.
it was just a what the hell moment. And I'm just the name of the game because that was not my intent at all.
Right. Oh, the mainstream media loves to make it controversial.
Yes, but the good thing about what we're doing versus like, I mean, again, if it was just like a retro collection of Jeff's games and you took that game and you put it in there without context, people might still be confused as to what the intentions were, but our ability to set it off like an artifact in a museum and then put the context on it, it's like, this was sardonic. This was this is an ironic political satire, but it also really goes to show you that, a lot of people are like, I don't want video games to be political. It's like video games have been political, always since the beginning. You're just not looking at the right video games. And so for us to be able to put that in and to explain that, to show that, hopefully that opens people's eyes up to, again, like, these stories of gaming history that just aren't getting told, but should be.
One of the things that I'm really growing to respect, and I absolutely knew that DE was capable of this because of its long history as well, making games. Jesus, I've got games in my collection dating back 30 years, I think, with Digital Eclipse at this point. Is this the new versions of these classic games? And you've got a new version of Grid Runner included, which, Jeff, I see you playing in some of the B-roll shots in the documentary. You are a physical hardcore. You get into it, man. I see you on that controller. It must be a thrill for you to play the DE smoothed over Grid Runner and check that out. And they've got like Vector Sector. And I what's it like for you to play some of Digital Eclipse's, arcade reimaginations that they've been doing?
Oh yeah, no, I think they're excellent. I really, really enjoyed the ones in the Atari collection.
And
the Grid Runner is fantastic because it is the original Grid Runner underneath it. And they've made it sort of, it feels, even though it's the same game running underneath, because they've made it look so smooth and nice, it actually feels better to play. But it's remarkable the way you can just like press the button and flip back and see that it really is the old game. It's the original Grid Runner. It's just been made much more accessible and approachable with this lovely coat of new paint on top of it. They've done a marvelous job of it, really.
Yeah, and the sort of cleaned up version of Karateka in the Karateka collection. I really want you guys to, maybe it's a little soon, but I want you to create a little collection of the DE, infused games that you've been putting out there. I think it would be really cool. I think there's people that maybe have been hesitant to dive into all of this history with all of these things that would have a blast just playing these great games as well that are made with so much, love and care. I think that would be a lot of fun.
I think people are going to have to buy the individual
that's the way.
But yes. But hopefully each new one that we do might serve as an entry point to a new person, because I hope that some LlamaSoft fans play, if they're just playing this one for the first time, think, oh, there's similar takes on, Karateka, and there's a similar take on the Atari history. Oh, I'll go back and do that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they're much more than games, right? They're documentaries. They're honest to goodness, like a look back on a life, on a look back on a whole career.
And the thought process behind it is, even if you've never heard of Jeff Minter or ever played any of these games, we're going to entertain you. We're going to teach you about something you've never seen before or heard of before. And by the end of it, you're gonna be a LlamaSoft fan, because you're probably going to find something in that vast catalog of games that speaks to you and is interesting to you.
Jeff, what do you look back on, outside of your own career? What are some of the, clearly Robotron and Defender, the Eugene Jarvis catalog is really important to you and to me and to many others out there. But are there other games that really touched a nerve for you, that really inspired you? Maybe you've collected them, maybe you go back to them, or you think fondly back on them. What are some of your favorites?
I always love the Atari Vector games. I mean, like Asteroids is a timeless classic. Tempest, of course. How could I not?
Of course.
Yeah. Atari Star Wars, the sit-down cabinet. I owned an Atari sit-down Star Wars cabinet back in the day. I'd love the aesthetic of those games. And again, I think it ties into my love of the kind of abstract stuff. So the wireframe, glowing vector stuff really, really appeals to me sort of aesthetically. So I love those. And a lot of those... Atari in particular, I think, were kind of my mate. Atari and Williams. I mean, Williams too. They had a particular style of their own. I mean, Robotron, I think, is one of the most perfect games ever made.
It is. Yeah. Eugene and I were just talking about that. It's timeless. It's absolutely timeless.
And it's just beautiful because it's all there on one screen. Yeah. Everything appears. You see the whole world and everything in it in one go, and you're given overwhelming, but you're given just enough firepower to fight your way out of it if you're good enough. And it's brutal, but it's harsh, but it's fair, and it's wonderful, beautiful game.
Absolutely. So hard to recreate unless you put llamas in it.
Well, my version was a lot softer. Because the thing, if you're doing a translation from the arcade to the home, you have to make it softer. Because the arcade wants to kick you off and take your money every 3 minutes.
Yes, yes.
That's not such a fun experience when you want to sit down for a good session at home. So it's not just a case of recreating an arcade game at home. You need to change it as well. Anyway, I'm going to have to go in a minute because I've got to be somewhere else.
It is time. Oh, Jesus. Yeah, this went too fast. Yeah, this was
such a
treat.
But I promise the other guys, the place where I was supposed to be tonight, I'm at least going to be there in video if I couldn't be there.
Oh, yeah. No worries. This time flew. You guys were just wonderful to chat with, and thank you both so much. And, you know, honestly, just huge congratulations on this project, and I hope everybody out there checks out LlamaSoft, the Jeff Minter collection. Thank you to Jeff Minter. Thank you to Chris Kohler. Thank you for watching and listening. Make sure you hit that thumbs up button and subscribe. We will see you soon. And until then, play forever.